The following teaching is part 6 in a 6-part series by Dr. Ken Boa, titled, Great Books Everyone Should Know, Series 2.
Tonight we're going to be looking at the works of someone who is kind of experiencing something of a resurgence in interest and popularity after a few hundred years, but someone whose works really had a profound impact on his own time and generation. A man who also understood what it was to suffer, and he experienced a tremendous amount of loss and pain and adversity in his life, partly through some choices that he himself made. His name is François Fenelon, F-E-N-E-L-O-N. And Fenelon is a man who was born in 1651, died in 1715, and in his brief 63 years had an extraordinary wealth of opportunities and really was headed toward tremendous prestige, wealth, and influence, and who later in his life came to the point where he lost his job, lost his fame, his money, and many of his friends. And so we have to understand something about Fenelon, that there is a choice that was made, a deliberate choice because of his integrity and his vision, that caused him to understand the crucible of suffering and whose teachings were forged in that crucible of affliction and adversity. So he was a man who really was a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. And like a follower of Jesus Christ, as a follower of Christ, he was profoundly influenced by the issue of the heart of God and came to understand the heart of God as a place that the human heart seeks and longs for, and the only place where our hearts will find rest. So there's a mystical strain in Fenelon, we'll talk about that, but it's counterbalanced by a very clear and keen mind. So he didn't go off to excesses, but he does teach a very real form of abandonment to the divine providence, but not a reckless passivity, but rather something that is, in fact, a proper and a consequent of God's loving and overtures and initiatives in our lives. When he was born then, he was born in an age that we might well call the golden age of French literature. Certainly this was a period of time where after the religious wars of the 16th century and all the conflict that that produced, as well as then the 30 years' war of the 17th century, there was tremendous disillusionment, particularly with religious institutions. And alongside of the kind of religious fanaticism that some people encountered during these centuries and the ineptitude of the church in some regards, especially in France, there was a great flowering at the same time of art and of music and of literature and of philosophy. So that what was taking place during François Fenelon's period of time in the 17th and 18th centuries was really a movement from Renaissance humanism to scientific rationalism. And so we came to embrace a very scientifically rational way of looking at the world. Francis Bacon, for example, who denounced reliance on authority and Aristotelian logic, calling for a new scientific method based on inductive generalization from careful observation and experiment. Galileo, of course, the science of mechanics and the application of the principles of geometry to the motions of body. Thomas Hobbes, the principles of mechanics applied to every field of knowledge. The law of self-preservation as the basis for human behavior. You think of René Descartes, who was insistent on a form of rigor in accepting beliefs that he denied even his own existence until he could prove it to be necessarily true. So he made mathematics a model for all science. During this time, then, what we have here is a permeation of this kind of thinking on every level of French society, including the church, which led to a movement away from room for the heart. It was much more of a rationalistic period of time, and the idea of mysticism, for example, especially in the medieval sort, Bernard of Clairvaux and William of St. Thierry and Aldred of Rivaux, others of that sort, moving through that period of time, that was something that was regarded as an anachronism. Something really was no longer appropriate. Even though there were people in France during this general period of time one of the best known now is the simple French monk known as Brother Lawrence, who lived from about 1620 to about 1691, determined to practice the presence of God. On the whole, however, there was a real movement away from that. So Fenelon really is an oddity for his own time in several different ways. May I just make a few comments? I'm only going to try to just give you some just brief overviews of his life, just a few suggestions, because obviously we have, that's a huge, that would be a large topic in and of itself. But I'll just pull out what I regard to be critical formational influences that will help you get a background for the life and times of a man whose spiritual correspondence has never been exceeded. And that's really what his genius has been known for today, is his Christian correspondence or spiritual correspondence with a wide variety of things, of people. Everyone from the court to people who were in poverty, and there was a remarkable influence in his letters, a richness that has, as I said, never been exceeded in France. As well, there was a kind of spiritual direction and mentoring that took place in these letters, pithy letters, filled with remarkable counsel and advice. There are a number of books that have been published of late that illustrate these. The one I'll be particularly focusing on is one that was published a few years ago by Bethany House called Christian Perfection. This was actually a paperback edition of an earlier book that came out in 1947 by that name. I'm afraid that both of those books are now out of print. There are other books, though, that are still in print or that are recently been done. One of them is called Meditations on the Heart of God. And it's a collection of some of Fenelon's letters. And we do carry that one at the Reflections Ministries office. Another one is called Talking with God, another collection of his many, many letters that were written, especially in the last 20 years of his life. And another book called The Seeking Heart. And again, this is a collection of correspondence. And so these books, I believe that at least the first two I've just mentioned, the Talking with God and Meditations on the Heart of God, they're in print. Things come and things go. These aren't books that would do well, really, in Christian bookstores today and would never be published if they came out new. It's just not the sort of thing. People, I fear, in the Christian community have an attraction to fluff and feel-good literature, simplistic black-and-white thinking, and the kinds of things that really, in my opinion, have not much substance, and the vast bulk of which will not be around 10 years from now, let alone 100. It's just the nature of it. And so it would be prudent for us, as I've said before, to return to those classics that really nourish the soul. And though they seem somehow remote to us, nevertheless, that's the very stuff that we need in order for us to be less parochial, less influenced by the prejudices and the limitations and the bounds of our own time. This is the kind of literature that can bring us out of that mindset. And frankly, Fenelon, you would find to be very accessible indeed. These letters are, generally speaking, fairly accessible. Now, during his childhood, as I say, he was born in 1651. During his childhood, the young Louis XIV had firmly suppressed a lot of disaffected nobles. And he was very clever because he contrived to keep the most powerful of them under his thumb by building the lavish palace of Versailles and enticing them to live there. So he had endless balls and theatrical and musical performances to keep them happy. And basically, there was a means whereby he could control the elite. And after his queen died in 1683, he married a devout Catholic named Madame de Maintenon in 1684. And it was not long before, in fact, it was around that period of time, that he revoked the Edict of Nantes, N-A-N-T-E-S. Now, this edict, which was given almost a century before that, in the year 1598, had granted at least a measure of religious liberty to Protestants. But Louis XIV's revocation of that liberty in the year 1685 created a tremendous upheaval and a loss of hundreds of thousands of Protestants who were then called Huguenots and who were disproportionately influential, by the way, in commerce and really the substructure, the infrastructure of French society. And France lost a great deal of stability by the loss of them, much more than they might have supposed. It was an incredible blunder from a historical standpoint, and it led to tremendous oppression. In any case, Fenelon would have some influence on these Protestants, as we'll see. He was schooled in various areas and completed his education in 1677, and he became, after his ordination, a superior of a Paris mission to new converts to the Catholic Church. In 1684, he was invited by a bishop named Bossuet, B-O-S-S-E-U-T, a figure who would figure very significantly in Fenelon's life, as you'll hear. One of France's finest orators and preachers. And Fenelon was his match as a preacher, as an orator. Remarkable skill. And in fact, Bossuet actually invited him to go on a preaching mission with that renowned prelate. Now, what then took place was that Fenelon was sent to work in an area which was a center of French Protestantism. And there he was very effective in working with the Protestants, and because of his gentle and gracious spirit, actually gradually even won the hearts of some of these Protestants and was very, very conciliatory during that period of time when he was working with them. But then after that mission to the Protestants was accomplished, he returned to Paris, and there he was elevated to the position of spiritual director to the Duke and Duchess of Beauvais and their family of eight daughters. And at that time he wrote even a little book, his first book, on the education of girls, which was a very perceptive work on education itself. The Duke of Beauvais was later named governor over the king's sons and grandsons, and this had a profound impact because, you see, Fenelon was that duke's family spiritual counselor and director, and now this man has been elevated to a position of tremendous influence in the court. The consequence was that Fenelon was made personal tutor to the king's grandson, the young Duke of Burgundy. This is no trivial thing, because the Duke of Burgundy was destined to become the next French king. He would become Louis XV. At least that's how the plan was. So it was his mission then to educate and tutor and to prepare him for his reign. Now, I might mention this was no easy task, because it turns out that this young whippersnapper here, especially, he started when the boy was 7 years old, and he was a holy terror from the very, very beginning. In any case, here's a description of someone who would be destined, if it were not for Fenelon, to become a tyrant. He was immensely obstinate, desperately fond of good eating, of hunting, of music, of games at which it was dangerous to play, and he could not endure to be beaten. He was disposed to be cruel, and he looked upon the rest of mankind as an inferior race with which he had nothing in common. Even his brothers, who were supposed to be brought up in precisely the same footing as himself, he considered as merely a sort of link between himself and the ordinary human race. So this young lad here would be causing great trouble. I mean, even when the clock struck the hour for dinner, and if he wasn't ready, he'd break the clock. I mean, he'd go on these rampages here, and people were told, when he's in one of his fits, just try to be quiet around him. Yet Fenelon, after a few years, won the boy's heart and developed quite a relationship, and his whole personality was changed in remarkable ways. And so that he became a young man who actually acquired real virtue and a real sense of devotion. This is a very significant thing, because this could have had a huge impact on French culture. The unfortunate result, I'll jump ahead, is that he would never become Louis XV. When Louis XIV's son died in 1711, it would then be natural for the young Duke of Burgundy to become heir to the throne. This, and the devout circles at court then had great hopes and expectations because of Fenelon's huge influence on him. Sadly, however, the young man died before Louis XIV. And so it would be the king's spoiled and inept great-grandson who took the throne as Louis XV. Who knows what things would have been? It's always interesting to ask the question, what would it have been like? And of course, one never knows, because even the slightest change, as you know, would change and have a reverberating impact that's utterly unpredictable. And one of the strange quirks of history, as there are so many of these, that can depend upon one life for another. What impact might that have had on the French Revolution, for example, if he was a benevolent king? What impact that would have had on the next? And who can guess what that might have had? However, that was not meant to be. My point here, though, is that Fenelon had a tremendous influence in his time and was given positions of great privilege. In fact, for the benefit of his young pupil, he wrote books called Fables, which were moral lessons in the form of fairy tales, Dialogues of the Dead. That sounds like a gruesome book, but actually, these were bygone historical figures who told what they learned from life. And he used this as a tutorial design. This is still actually sometimes being printed. And also he wrote a commentary in epic style on how kings ought to reign called The Adventures of Telemachus. And this book is what got Fenelon in great trouble later on. It was never meant to be published. You'll see in just a minute, though. In any case, as a result of being tutored to the heir of to the throne, he gained access to the court of Versailles, where a number of devout Christians welcomed his presence, and through evangelism and building into their lives, had many, many spiritual children. And as I say, his friendship and correspondence with them continued throughout the rest of his life, and we are the heirs to that correspondence. One of his correspondents was the queen, Madame de Maintenon, who had founded a school for girls of impoverished nobility. And he was also elevated to the Académie Française, the French Academy, in 1693. He then became Archbishop of Cambrai in 1695. And as a result of that position, there were tremendous titles and wealth that were associated with that position. And ultimately, he was heading for a course that would have eventually bring him the cardinal's cap. He would have become probably almost certainly a cardinal and would have been then in a tremendous power of wealth, privilege, and prestige. All of this was to change. In the year 1688, he met a woman by the name of Jean Guillon. And Madame Guillon, who lived from 1648 to 1717, was a woman who, although had certain personal eccentricities, was deeply versed and also deeply experienced in the mystical way, the prayer of the heart. And she tremendously influenced Fenelon and ultimately, in fact, caused him to see a real need for the abandonment again to God's providential care. Another theme of another Frenchman who would come later, Jean de Caussade, abandonment to the divine providence, or also the sacrament of the present moment. So you have this literature that's sometimes called quietism, though it doesn't need to lead to a kind of a true passivity. But in its best moments and its best experiences, though criticized by the Pope and by many in the Catholic hierarchy, does have its advantages, though it can lead off to too much of a passivity. We are creatures of extremes, aren't we? We are either activists or quietists. We'll go off to one side or the other, although most of us in our culture tend toward the activism side. But there are some who, in this spiritual way, so lean in the other opposite direction that there's almost a passivity, a kind of a let go, let God mindset that's carried too far. But still, I think because of Fenelon's balance, he brought in perspective in this. In any case, she herself got into serious trouble when the Archbishop of Paris criticized her work. She was imprisoned, and then later on she was imprisoned a second time when her former protectress, Madame de Maintenon, actually began to find her teaching suspect, so she no longer had that support, thrown into prison for a number of years. It turns out, only in the 20th century did we discover that there was a secret correspondence between Fenelon and Madame Guillon. It was not known until very, very recently that they had carried on a secret correspondence. What had taken place, though, that Fenelon actually encountered, because he tried to defend her and her position, he got in serious trouble, and he knew where it was going to head. He knew he was risking everything in order to defend her position. And in his defense, actually, they wrote books back and forth. Bossuet would write a book to condemn her. Fenelon would write a book to defend her. Then they'd write books about it in response to each other's books, and then another books about each other. So we had this one on back and forth, and it was a very intense thing. And so he became really Fenelon's enemy, and actually then brought him to the point where when he published a book in 1697, Maxims of the Saints, this work was attacked by Bossuet as inconsistent with traditional Christian teachings. These two prelates then appealed to Rome, and parts of the book were condemned by the Pope in 1699. And as a result of all this, Fenelon was getting serious trouble, and then his spiritual writings were condemned. But not only that, this book, Telemachus, I mentioned earlier, was published without his permission. This got him in trouble with the king because, you see, and this is the book for which Fenelon, by the way, is best known in secular history, it states that kings exist for the benefit of their subjects and it denounces war. Well, Louis XIV took this as a direct barb against him. And so he sent Fenelon off to exile in his own province there and was no longer allowed to, he was stripped from his position of courts and at court and exiled to his own diocese. And what's remarkable about this is there's not a trace of bitterness and this loss. His strength of character came through very, very clearly. And in spite of his condemnation and exile, right up to his death in 1715, he never ceased his correspondence with those at court who had become his spiritual children. And so he was a remarkable influence and encouraged Christians since that time to develop a far closer communion with God and a real understanding of their struggles. That's been a source of profound discouragement because he himself understood what it was to have it all and to lose it all and to make choices. He was a man who was said of him that he was dead to vanity. As one contemporary wrote, it was difficult to take one's eyes off of him. Speaking of Fenelon, he possessed a natural eloquence, grace, and finesse, and a most insinuating, yet noble and appropriate courtesy, an easy, clear, agreeable utterance, a wonderful power of explaining the hardest matter in a lucid, distinct manner. He was a man who never sought to seem cleverer than those with whom he conversed, who brought himself insensibly to their level, putting them at their ease, and enthralling them so, one could neither leave him nor mistreat him, nor help seeking him again. Another person wrote of him, "I have seen him adapt himself within a short space of time to all classes, associating with the great and using their style without any loss of episcopal dignity, and then turning to the lowly and young, like a kind of father teaching his children. There was no effort or affection in his readiness to turn from one to the other. It seemed as though his mind naturally embraced all varieties." So we have an interesting character here, a man who understood what it was to suffer great rejection and grief, and who was somehow indifferent to the things that impressed people. He could work just as well with people who were well-educated and people of position, prestige, and power, and knew what that was like. But he also gave his heart and his life, especially in the last years of his life during his exile to his diocese, to the poor and to the destitute. And so he was also able to sympathize with them. A remarkable range. And he could adapt himself without really somehow being condescending to people. He was able to adapt himself to their needs. And a man of great passion and purpose. I'd like to just bring out then some of my favorite bits in his letters. And so I'm just going to limit myself just to this one little book because you could just go on and on, but I'm going to limit myself to this book that I mentioned earlier called Christian Perfection. And within that, I'll just limit myself to a few insights. But again, when you're reading something like these letters of spiritual counsel and of direction, you need to keep in mind the way you read that. Again, this is not ordinary literature. When you're dealing with devotional reading, as I've said before, you need to have an attentive receptiveness of the whole person to that literature. It's therefore to be read with humility, with receptivity, and in a context of reflection and a sense of being rather than just doing. You want to read it slowly enough to absorb its material and stop when an image strikes you. And so it's almost a way of really, in a time of quietude, limiting our attention. This is you'd limit your attention to a single painting. I mean, the idea of quick, Where's the Mona Lisa as someone runs to the Louvre is not the way to really enjoy the painting. It reminds me of Henri Nouwen's The Return of the Prodigal Son. You recall when he described how utterly impressed he was by Rembrandt's painting of that title. And when he saw it in the Hermitage Museum in what is now has been renamed after Leningrad, St. Petersburg, and as I mentioned before, when I was teaching in Russia, I had the opportunity to go to that museum and to just stand before that painting for a good while and to reflect on that, having read Nouwen's book. Nouwen studied that painting day after day for a period of time. He absorbed it, and great works of art require time and attention to see the nuances in the images, things you wouldn't see otherwise. This is, I think, one of the reasons why he came up with some insights that I've never seen before in that wonderful parable. And I'm digressing, but just quickly, the idea of your being the prodigal, everyone understands that. Of us also being the elder brother, we can understand that. That's really the direction that Jesus was directing the parable against the Pharisees as the elder brother. But the idea that one could third become and take the position of being the father and actually come to the point of maturity where they play the role of the father and welcome others into their arms in a certain way. And that was a very remarkable insight. And so I'd strongly recommend that. That may be one of my books that I do in the days ahead. It's certainly a rich book, and I believe will be a spiritual classic for various reasons. But in any case, this is the way you study this literature. You take your time with it, just as you take your time with a great work of art. You read it and reread it over the years. And to be perfectly frank with you, this is an excuse for me. You see, by doing this, it forces me to go back to and revisit some of these great works. So actually, I'm being a little selfish because it forces me to think more deeply than I probably otherwise would do. So that's one of the reasons why I do this as well. You want to catch from Fenelon and from these writers something by contagion. You catch their spirit, and though dead, they still speak. And you catch something about what they were like. And so we enter into companionship with this friend of God, and we see this idea of the underground work that's hidden from the eyes of people, that we receive this material. Frankly, a lot of his letters deal with issues, for example, of everyday living, temptations, distractions in prayer and worship. All of us have experienced those. Never-ceasing interior warfare of the soul. We've all experienced that. Conflicting claims of self and God, whether we're going to become theocentric or egocentric, is always going to be a challenge in our lives, is it not? It's always a challenge. Bearing of our faults. How do we bear our faults? How do we bear with the faults of others? What about the stubborn factor in our lives of suffering and the unexpected deprivations we encounter and the crosses that we never can anticipate, but there they come? What about the tainting power of self-love and the need of purgation by God and God's severe mercies? All of these are themes of Fenelon's letters. And consequently, he's a man who forces us to think deeply, not in a trivial way. That's why I say it won't be popular in most bookstores today. It forces us to think below the surface of life to the really deeper issues. In a letter concerning the use of time, Fenelon says that a person does not only lose time by doing nothing or doing what is wrong, he also loses it by doing something other than that which he ought to do, even though what he does is good. Now, this is an important insight, the difference between the good and the best. We're strangely ingenious in perpetually seeking our own interest, which is true, and what worldly souls do crudely and openly, people who want to live for God, often do more subtly, with the help of some pretext, which serving them as a screen stops them from seeing the ugliness of their behavior. So what he's doing, he cuts with a finer scalpel than most, and he causes us to see some of our own cleverness, what we suppose is cleverness, our self-righteousness, and he cuts through that as well, where we actually pose and posture, putting a Christian veneer, a kind of a surface on the same kind of practices, but we can often deceive ourselves. He talks about the idea as a general rule of receiving from moment to moment whatever it pleases God to give us, referring to him at once in the doubts which we necessarily run into, turning to him in the weakness into which goodness slips from exhaustion, calling on him and lifting oneself to him when the heart, swept away by material things, sees itself led imperceptibly off the path and finds itself forgetting and drifting away from God. So he talks about this very issue here, that we need to integrate an entire life, our business and outside affairs, our social contacts and diversions. Having a practice of Christian vigilance in our use of time is one of the themes in his letters. He says in another letter, we should never finish if we wanted constantly to sound the bottom of our hearts, and in wanting to escape from self in the search for God, we should be too preoccupied with self in such frequent examination. So he says, actually, your hyper-examination of yourself can be another form, even though you think it's an act of humility, it can be another a subtle form of pride. So he discusses that as well. He talks about the idea of a will which is no longer divided between God and any creature, a will pliant in his hands, which neither desires anything nor refuses anything, which wants without reservation everything which he wants, and which never, under any pretext, wants anything which he does not want. He calls this a simple will, which is entirely filled with that of God, wherever his providence leads you, to seek him in the hours where he seems distant and so forth. So he discusses this fact that God will often choose for you and me what we would not choose for ourselves. We all understand this. But what he's talking about, though, is the kind of abandonment that expects that there will be times and mysteries and crosses and deprivations that can be used by God's hand and purposes to draw us, even drive us to God, if we will receive them as such, and to understand then that what appears to be good or bad to us is really something that we must receive from the hand of God as something that always has a loving intention behind it. An unrelenting renunciation of all which does not, moment by moment, enter into God's plans, that he discusses a purity of intention, and a desire for a person then to be consistent and to pursue him with genuine passion and purpose. Regular times of evening and morning, in the evening and morning when one does this, never allowing ourselves to be swept away by outward affairs, however good they may be, to the point of not finding the time to take our own nourishment. And so he discusses what we all well know, the fact that we have an awesome ability to make time for the things we want to do. We have an awesome ability to do that. And to somehow suppose that it's a great sacrifice to do some things that the Lord invites us to do. He invites us to come away for a while and to walk away from the things that so distract us and take away from our inner life. Whenever we do that, the times when we do it, what do we regard it as? A great sacrifice and cross and indeed. We could easily spend 4 hours in an evening watching sports or sitcoms or a movie, whatever, without even a second thought about doing that. But imagine a person saying, I think I'm going to spend 4 hours tonight from 6 to 10 in the presence of God. They'd say, my word, the person's ready to be a monk. You see what happens here. We regard one as a great, great extreme in sacrifice, but we don't think anything about frittering our time away when things at least that it distract and sometimes actually put us in a trance-like state. And certainly don't enhance relationships with ourselves and those who happen to be in the room at the time. So the point here is that the human heart and human nature hasn't changed a whole lot, really, over these years. There are insights that he has, I think, that are very timeless. Has a letter on crosses, letters on mortification and recollection. Again, these are not the most popular topics. Mortification, my word. And it sounds rigid and inflexible, but actually what he's talking about here is being torn away from the things of from illusions so that we can lay hold of what is true joy. He's not talking about a loss. He always goes back to what one gains by that apparent loss of the self's autonomy. And so he really speaks actually about the simplicity of a child, and to be a sturdy child who fears nothing, who speaks out frankly, who lets himself be led, who is carried in the arms. In a word, one who knows nothing, can do nothing, can anticipate and change nothing, but who has a freedom and a strength forbidden to the great. This childhood baffles the wise, and God himself speaks by the mouth of such children. So what he means then is that you receive all things ultimately from the hand of God, and have a sense of gratitude for the graces that are often bestowed upon us in unexpected ways. He discusses a good deal the presence of God, and so would very much be in sympathy with the likes of a brother Lawrence, the idea of practicing his presence, and being accustomed to recollect ourselves during the day. To recall, who am I and why am I here? Where did I come from? Where am I going? Those kinds of questions. He says, let us thus quiet all the movements of our hearts as soon as we see them agitated. Let us separate ourselves from all pleasure which does not come from God. Cut off futile thoughts and dreams and so forth, not speaking empty words. So he talks about that. And he also talks about another thing that's one of the themes of these great writers and mystics. Not only being aware and practicing the presence of God, but what I would call fidelity in little things. Fidelity in little things. Most of your life is going to be made of these little things. And really, faithfulness in the small decisions of life is really where it all really matters. It's not the big mountaintop experiences, but often the spiritual life is led in fidelity in the small areas. He is a jealous God who wants no reservations, and he commands us to love him and describes this. If we don't give him everything, he wants nothing. And the idea of giving him all that we are and all we have. He talks about this idea then that we can't count on anything really with, it would be rash to suppose we can be presuming the future. The future is an abyss which God is hiding from us. And even when it comes to us, can we so count on ourselves that we should pretend to do God's work without his grace? So he discusses this idea. And again, with faithfulness in little things, he talks about God's wanting a pure intention, another theme that I see often. A.W. Tozer talks a lot about that, the idea of your intention. Not perfection, Tozer wrote, but holy intention is really what pleases the heart of God. None of us attain perfection in this life, but we can be characterized and marked by what do we intend, what do we seek, what do we long for. You become, at the end, Tozer told us, the sum total of what you desire. You are shaped by your aspirations and become conformed to that which you most long for. God would wish that we would long more for him than for anything in the created order, but we often miss out and settle for things that are second best. One of my favorite lines from Fenelon is this next line found in his letter concerning little things. The most dangerous thing is that the soul, by the neglect of little things, becomes accustomed to unfaithfulness. You see, it's easy for us to focus so much on big things that we neglect the little things, and after a while, bit by bit, you accustom yourselves to unfaithfulness in those small things, and then it has an almost invisible magnifying effect that can begin to become obvious in larger things. Again, like the pianist who said, you know, if I mispractice for one day, I can tell the difference. If I mispractice 2 days in a row, my critics can tell the difference. And if I miss 3 days in a row, my audience can tell the difference. You see, a lack of fidelity a little bit can eventually lead to a lack of fidelity in larger areas of life. And eventually it can become noticeable. Eventually, it's noticeable. It's by a slow erosion. I think of Woody Allen's Crimes and Misdemeanors, which is based upon Dostoevsky's Crime and Punishment. Again, both of them illustrating the slow, slippery slide into things that a person wouldn't even dream of doing at the beginning of the novel or the film, but later ends up doing and then thinks that they got away with it. Fenelon writes in another letter, people who are far from God think that they are very near to him when they begin to take a few steps to approach him. The most polite and most enlightened people have the same stupidity about this as a peasant who thinks he's really at court because he's seen the king. We leave the horrible vices, we restrain ourselves in a weak, worldly, and dissipated life. We judge it not by the gospel, which is the only rule, but by the comparison which we make between that life and the one which we led before, or which we see led by so many others. No more is needed to canonize ourselves and to go sound asleep so far as everything goes, which has to do with our salvation. So he's saying here, by comparing ourselves with other people, or by supposing that we're doing better than others, or confusing the standards of Christians with Christian standards, we can deceive ourselves into thinking we're a good deal more spiritual than we really are. And so he discusses this idea. Then he talks about people's fear to advance too far in the love of God. He says, what blindness that is. Let's plunge into it. The more we love him, the more we love also all that which he makes us do. And it's his love which consoles us in our losses, which softens our crosses for us, which detaches us from all which it is dangerous to love, which preserves us from a thousand poisons, which shows us a benevolent compassion through all the ills which we suffer, which even in death opens for us internal joy and happiness. So he's talking not on a negative level, but talking about the benefits, really, of not fearing what God would have for us. Most of us, I'd say the major, if I had to single out one fundamental issue that keeps you from going further than you are now, it would be that word trust. We are terrified, afraid of trusting him enough to stop fearing what it would do if we recklessly abandon ourselves to his providence. We're terrified of that, the loss of control, the loss, the abyss of the future, and all of that. But frankly, you're far worse trying to do it and go it alone. You're really out of control then. You're far worse. And frankly, you will not be capable of making the kind of decisions that omniscience would know what's best for you, and benevolence, God's benevolent will, would always want and choose for us. Again, we would tend to, as C.S. Lewis put it in The Problem of Pain, ask God to love us less, not more, when we invite him to back off from those kinds of experiences. He talks about the imitation of Jesus Christ. The nothing believes itself something, and the all-powerful makes himself nothing. He talks contrasting man and God. I make myself nothing with thee, Lord. I make thee the entire sacrifice of my pride, of the vanity which possesses me up to the present. Help my good intention, keep me from the occasions of my falling. And he discusses this contrast here and looks at the life of Christ. And comparing our life with that of Christ, let's remember he's the master and that we are the slaves, that he is all-powerful, we are only weakness. He lowers ourselves, himself, we raise ourselves. And so there's this remarkable contrast that he seeks to correct. Speaking about a number of other issues, he talks about the true liberty. Whoever works to let go of himself, to forget himself, to renounce himself, following the precepts of Jesus Christ, cuts at one blow the root of all his vices and finds in the simplest renunciation of himself the seed of all virtues. Not to say that this is an easy thing to do. The renunciation of our own autonomy is no easy task. And again, many of these writers of this ilk will talk about that. God wants children who love his goodness and not slaves who only serve him for the fear of his power. So we must love him and consequently do all which inspires true love. Happy the man who gives himself to God, he goes on to say. He is delivered from his passions, from the judgments of men, from their malice, from the tyranny of their sayings. And by the way, this is a major theme in Fenelon's life. He was delivered from the tyranny of the opinions and judgments of other people. That's why he could accept with equanimity whether he'd be elevated to a high position of prestige and influence, an enviable position indeed, or to see that power dissolve and to take on an identification in his own diocese with the needs of the poor and the destitute. I see a man who has an equal way of moving through that and saying yes to whatever God's yes is and whatever his will is, and no to whatever God's will is against. And I see him seeing that because he sees that this life is really for the preparation of the soul's journey into God himself. In any case, we go on. I'm virtually out of time, but I'll just pull out just a few more thoughts. He talks about the brevity and uncertainty of life, the inconstancy of fortune. He understands that. The unfaithfulness of friends, he grasped that. The illusion of great positions, this he understood. The bitterness which is inevitable there, the discontent of the great, the disappointment of all the greatest hopes, the emptiness of all the good things we possess, the reality of all the evils we suffer. And he says this only skims the surface of our hearts. The depths of man are not changed at all. He sighs to see himself a slave of vanity, but doesn't leave his bondage. So he talks about people who can really sigh over those things, but still they're in bondage to their own vanity. And so he says we need to have to really see in God the nothingness of the world, which will vanish in a little while like smoke. All the grandeurs and their paraphernalia will flee away like a dream. Hey, this isn't theoretical. You know it's true. You know this. How much, you know, your life is but a vapor. We know that this will all be gone. All height will be brought low. All power will be crushed. Every superb head will be low, bowed beneath the weight of the eternal majesty of God. In the day when he will judge men, he will obliterate with one look all that shines in the present night, as the sun in rising puts out the stars. We shall see only God everywhere, so great will he be. We shall seek in vain, we will find only him, so he will fill all things. Where have they gone, we shall say, those things which have charmed our hearts? What is left of them? Where were they? Alas, not even the marks of the place where they have been remain. They have passed like a shadow which the sun dissolves. It is hardly true to say that they have been. It is so true to say that they have only appeared and that they are no more. So this is a reflection. That's why he says the time draws near, it comes. Let us hasten to be ready for it. Let us love the eternal beauty which does not grow old and which stops those from growing old who love it only. You see that? There's the hope. It stops those from growing old who love it only. That's why Paul could say that the outer man is perishing, but the inner man is being renewed day by day. And so there's that in you which is forever young, which is going to be really the childlike wonder and awe and grace and glory that God's preparing for us. So he is not simply looking in a negative way, but he looks beyond to the greater things. He says, lift your eyes to the heights and to see that which will endure. Do not allow yourself to be consumed by the passions that will perish. What has become of the great actors who filled the scene 30 years ago? But without going too far, how many of them have died in the last 7 or 8 years? Soon we shall follow them. Is this then the world to which we are so devoted? We only pass through it. We are on our way out. It itself is misery, vanity, folly. It's only a phantom, a passing figure, as St. Paul said. So he discusses this concept of the abandonment to God is not an escape into an illusion, but rather into reality itself. Talks about suffering love, about interior peace, helps in dissipation and sadness. I'm going to pass over a lot of these things, but in this one section, I wanted to point out one thing that I think is remarkable. Again, one of his major themes, when we're really abandoned to God, all that we do well without doing many things, we abandon ourselves with confidence to the future. He goes on to say, this forgetting of self is the most perfect penitence because all conversion only consists of renouncing self to be engrossed in God. Not just renouncing self, no. It is to be engrossed in God. It is therefore to focus the eye away from the self and all its illusions and follies, and to abandon oneself then in the presence and power and peace of the living God. The vigilance which Jesus Christ commands is a faithful attention, always to love and do the will of God in the present moment, following the indications that we have of it. It does not consist, however, in upsetting ourselves, tormenting ourselves, being constantly preoccupied with ourselves, rather than lifting our eyes to God, only help against ourselves. And so again, he focuses on this. He says, the way you get your eye off yourself is to focus on Christ, rather than just to try to get your eye off yourself. He's saying there's a better vision to pursue. So this conflict of egocentricity over against theocentricity becomes a major theme in his writing. He moves from egocentricity to a blind deference to the power of public opinion, and moving away from that blind deference, and to find oneself's joy in the all and in all. Just a couple of other quotes. So he speaks about self-forgetfulness. When we forget self, we're no longer deliberately seeking our own interest. We usually keep ourselves out of the picture. We don't regard ourselves for love of ourselves, but the vision of God which we seek often results in a new view of ourselves. It's like a man who looks at another behind whom there is a great mirror. In considering the other, he sees himself and discovers himself without intending to. You ever have that image there? Just for a split second, you see yourself as you really are because you weren't expecting to look into a mirror. And who's that person? Then for a split second, you saw yourself as others would see you. Doesn't last long. But he's talking about this idea of the reality of being so absorbed into the love of God that more and more we become increasingly dependent upon him. We embrace the word of God within us and come to revel in the fact that we become his possessions. We want to possess thee, but we do not want to lose ourselves so that we can be possessed by thee. This is not loving thee. So he says, you've got to lose yourself so that you are possessed by him rather than trying to be the one who is in control of that situation. Talks about privations, self-renunciation. and near the end of at the end of this book, at least, discusses the virtues of simplicity and that of humility. Just a word about humility, and we'll close. Concerning humility, which he knows is very elusive, because you become aware of it, that's the problem. He is so completely forgets himself that he never thinks of self, who has no turning back on himself, who within, and by the way, he honestly says, look, this isn't, you're never going to be achieving this perfectly. You have to understand this. It's in fits and starts, but you don't bump, you don't somehow punish yourself. You go back once you're aware that you've forgotten God and are consumed with yourself. You return to that as a skill. He goes on to say, though, who speaks of himself as he would speak of someone else, who does not affect forgetting self when he is full of it, who gives himself up to charity without noticing whether it is humility or pride to act in that way, who is quite content to pass as being not humble at all. Finally, he who is full of charity is really humble. He who does not seek his own interest, but the interest of God alone in time and for eternity is humble. The more we love purely, the more perfect is our humility. Let us then not measure humility by the fabricated exterior. Let us not make it depend on one action or another, but on pure charity. Pure charity divests man of himself, it reclothes him with Jesus Christ. This is what true humility consists, which makes us live no longer for ourselves, but lets Jesus Christ live in us. So this is his theme of really receiving from life a true humility as one of those children of whom Jesus Christ has said that the kingdom of heaven belongs to. A child does not know what he needs. He can do nothing, he thinks of nothing, but he lets himself be led. Let us abandon ourselves then with courage. If God makes nothing of us, he will give us justice because we are good for nothing, and if he makes great things, the glory will be his. We shall say with Mary that he has done great things in us because he has regarded our low estate. May I close with this little one-liner from Aeschylus, the Greek dramatist, and actually most of his plays were comedies. But Aeschylus said something that I found to be remarkable and summarizes a good deal about this issue of suffering we've just been talking about. He says, even in our sleep, pain that cannot forget falls drop by drop upon the heart, and in our own despair, against our will, comes wisdom through the awful grace of God. Let me close in a prayer. Father, we thank you that you have cared for us and that you know what your children need, and it often does not correspond to what we want. Yet at the end, we know when we see you face to face that what we need and what we want are one and the same when we are transformed into the image of Christ. So we will want what you want fully. May we move in that direction, though, of abandonment to your providence as the abandonment of a child into the lap of the father or of the loving mother. May we receive your loving embrace and revel in that so that we will be a people who quiet our souls and who move into that interior simplicity, that intention of pursuing the one thing most needful. We pray in Christ's name. Amen.
This concludes Dr. Ken Boa's teaching. For more information about Reflections Ministries, please visit us on the web at www.reflectionsministries.org.